A funny thing happened on the way to Dane Allred. Time travel. I time travel all the time. So do you. Most of us set an alarm to get us up in the morning. Then the next morning the alarm goes off because you've traveled to the future to remind yourself to get up. My memory is getting so bad, I need to leave myself notes. I'll put a note on the seat of my car in the morning at work to remind me to do something after work. I know many of you use planners to remind us what to do in the future. What if we read a note from ourselves 50 years from now that said, "Don't forget to be happy today"? I like reminders, except when I don't want them. Like a reminder to get a colonoscopy, which I know I need but don't want to be reminded about. I don't like it when the dentist reminds me to come and get my teeth cleaned. I don't want to be reminded. I need my car inspected and registered. But again, those are good reminders. When I travel in time, most days now it is back in time. I think I'm much younger than I really am, and working with young people most of the time doesn't help. The time travel machine called a mirror is the one I really hate. When I walk past it, I curse it for the wrinkles it adds to what I still consider my youthful face. But I wouldn't trade the experiences I've gained for renewed youth. Reminders can come in many forms. We learn to like our birthdays less and less as we get older, but they really shouldn't cause us to mourn. We should be thinking about how lucky we are to make it to another landmark. I have some friends who didn't. I'll be sharing another story about Dane Bromley in a minute, but I remember the day I was sitting in my drama class. I was called on the intercom to the office in high school, and my mom was on the phone. She told me that Dane had been hit by a truck and killed. He was walking down the street, and a truck hit him. I don't know if the truck was too far off the road or if Dane was walking too close to the road. All I know is he was dead, and I had a sickening, sinking feeling and broke out in tears. I hadn't seen him in years, but we were as close as two guys with the same name could be. I composed myself and went back to class with red eyes. The next week was a blur as I went to the church, the funeral, acted as a pallbearer, and I only remember a little bit about the whole thing. I only have a few things left to remind me about the great times we had together, but this memory is like traveling back to junior high. Since we were both named Dane, not really a common name, we immediately struck up a great friendship. We must have terrorized the halls of our junior high because one day the vice principal came up to both of us as we were sitting outside a classroom on the floor. He asked us why we had been tormenting our student teacher, who up until that point we both thought really liked us. That just shows how clueless we were, and it's probably a good indication of what troublemakers we were. We had caused her to cry, and here we thought she really liked us. But that's the way guys are in junior high. We even used to slug girls we liked. What was that about? But time travel also works both ways. I try not to think about how my grandfather always carried a handkerchief and used to blow his nose pretty often. I now carry a handkerchief, and yes, I do blow my nose more often than I like. Trotsky said it this way: old age is one of the most unexpected things to happen to a man. I guess that includes women, too. But I'm also guessing Leon Trotsky said this in the last part of his life, and not the first. The point of all this rambling is that we're on a journey where we get one day at a time, and most of us take it for granted. As Henry David Thoreau said, we should not get to the end of our life and discover we had never lived. Let us live so when our daily reminder to get up in the morning goes off, whether it's an alarm, the sun, or something else, we acknowledge that fact. Let's live. I mean, really live and recognize today is the only day we've been given. As Horace said, seize the day. This is Abundance. I'm your host, Dane Allred. Today we're examining Miracles, number 631 from my list of 1,001 thanks. Each week on Abundance, we celebrate one of the 1,001 things I'm thankful for my list of 1,001 thanks. This week, miracles, number 631 is our topic. Today we're going to be hearing chapter 11 and 12 from The Plotter's Mile and continue with our new feature on Abundance called Biography. Well, here's some poems by Robert Frost and selections. Already you've heard today, time travel from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Dane Allred, and later, some from Dane Allred's Partly Colored Dreamcoat. Welcome to Biography Out Loud. I am your host, Dane Allred. This author once said, by working faithfully 8 hours a day, you may eventually get to be a boss and work 12 hours a day. Though he delivered newspapers and was a cobbler, farmer, and the light bulb filament changer in a factory, he always felt his true calling was as a poet. He also worked as a teacher and won 4 Pulitzer Prizes for poetry. He's renowned for his ability to capture rural life and colloquial language. Who is this rural poet, regarded as one of the most famous American authors? We'll find out in a moment on Biography Out Loud. Robert Frost's epitaph quotes a line from one of his poems, "I had a lover's quarrel with the world." Best known for his poem, "The Road Not Taken," the lines most often cited from this poem include, "Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference." He sold his first poem, "My Butterfly, an Elegy," at the age of 20 for $15. This early success caused him to propose to Eleanor. She refused his first proposal, but later agreed to marriage. They were in England when World War I broke out, and Robert Frost then returned with his family to what would be the family homestead. Robert Frost met Ezra Pound while in England. Pound helped promote Robert Frost's poetry by reviewing his first book of poetry, but their friendship waned in later years. Frost said of life, "In 3 words, I can sum up everything I've learned about life. It goes on." His father died when he was 11, his mother when he was 26, and he also had to commit his sister to an institution. He and his wife had 6 children, but they were only survived by 2 of their daughters. He buried his wife in 1938, and though faced with much tragedy in his life, he said, "Happiness makes up in height for what it lacks in length." He also said, "The best way out is always through." Later in his life, he taught at the University of Michigan and received more than 40 honorary degrees in his lifetime. Of education, he once said, "Education is the ability to listen to almost anything without losing your temper." Robert Frost performed a reading of his poetry at the inauguration of John F. Kennedy at the age of 86. Frost enjoyed reading his works and once said, "I look at a poem as a performance." Of Robert Frost, President Kennedy said, "He has bequeathed his nation a body of imperishable verse from which Americans will forever gain joy and understanding." His use of common language to communicate in poetry makes Frost one of the most famous American poets. His wit has also been frequently quoted. He once said, "A jury consists of 12 persons chosen to decide who has the better lawyer." He worked on various farms his entire life, commenting he had no regular writing schedule. He said, "I don't have hours. I don't work at it, you know. I'm not a farmer. That's no pose of mine. But I have farmed some, and I putter around. And I walk and live with other people. Like to talk a lot." Though his life was checkered with loss, he once said, "I never knew how many disadvantages anyone needed to get anywhere in the world. No psychology will ever tell you who needs a whip and who needs a spur to win races." When asked once about the creative process, Robert Frost said, "It's just the same as when you feel a joke coming. You see somebody coming down the street that you're accustomed to abuse and feel it rising in you, something to say as you pass each other, coming over him the same way. And where do those thoughts come from?" In 1942, Robert Frost received his 4th Pulitzer Prize for his book, A Winter Tree. He is the first person to win 4 Pulitzer Prizes. He also once had patchwork quilts made from the academic hoods he'd received with his many honorary degrees. In a memorable couplet, Frost once said, "It's from their having stood contrasted that good and bad so long have lasted." Frost was born in 1874, but maintained his entire life he was born in 1875. His friends threw a 50th birthday party for him as he turned 51, and he was honored by the U.S. Senate for his 75th birthday, although he was already 76. Robert Frost, one of the most accomplished American poets, died in 1963. He once quipped, "Half the world is composed of people who have something to say and can't, and the other half who have nothing to say and keep on saying it." You are listening to Abundance, where we celebrate 1001 ways to be thankful and operate from an attitude of abundance, not of scarcity. All 33 selections from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Dane Allred are available at eBay and DaneAllred.com. You can also read and listen to all the episodes on DaneAllred.podbean.com, at 1001thanks.blogspot.com, and these selections can also be downloaded for you to listen to anytime you like on iTunes. It's 20 minutes past the hour. feature out loud, The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry, I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though, as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same, and both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh. Somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by. And that has made all the difference. Literature Out Loud, Birches by Robert Frost. When I see birches bend to left and right across the lines of straighter, darker trees, I like to think some boy's been swinging them. But swinging doesn't bend them down to stay. Ice storms do that. Often you must have seen them loaded with ice a sunny winter morning after a rain. They click upon themselves as the breeze rises and turn many-colored as the stir cracks and crazes their enamel. Soon the sun's warmth makes them shed crystal shells, shattering and avalanching on the snow crust, such heaps of broken glass to sweep away, you'd think the inner dome of heaven had fallen. They are dragged to the withered bracken by the load, and they seem not to break. Though once they're bowed so low for long, they never right themselves. You may see their trunks arching in the woods years afterwards, trailing their leaves on the ground, like girls on hands and knees that throw their hair before them over their heads to dry in the sun. But I was going to say, when truth broke in with all her matter of fact about the ice storm, I should prefer to have some boy bend them as he went out and in to fetch the cows. Some boy too far from town to learn baseball, whose only play was what he found himself, summer or winter, and could play alone. One by one he subdued his father's trees by riding them down over and over again until he took the stiffness out of them, and not one but hung limp, not one was left for him to conquer. He learned all there was to learn about not launching out too soon and so not carrying the tree away clear to the ground. He always kept his poise to the top branches, climbing carefully with the same pains you use to fill a cup up to the brim and even above the brim. Then he flung outward, feet first with a swish, kicking his way down through the air to the ground. So was I once myself a swinger of birches, and so I dream of going back to be. It's when I'm weary of considerations, and life is too much like a pathless wood, where your face burns and tickles with the cobwebs, broken across it, and one eye is weeping from a twig's having lashed across it open. I'd like to get away from earth a while, and then come back to it and begin over. May no fate willfully misunderstand me and half grant what I wish and snatch me away not to return. Earth's the right place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better. I'd like to go by climbing a birch tree and climb black branches up a snow-white trunk toward heaven till the tree could bear no more, but dipped its top and set me down again. That would be good, both going and coming back. One could do worse than be a swinger of birches. Picture Out Loud. Acceptance by Robert Frost. When the spent sun throws up its rays on cloud and goes down burning into the gulf below, no voice in nature is heard to cry aloud at what has happened. Birds at least must know it is the change to darkness in the sky. Murmuring something quiet in her breast, one bird begins to close a faded eye, or, overtaken too far from his nest, hurrying low above the grove, some waif swoops just in time to his remembered tree. At most, he thinks or twitters softly, "Safe. Now let the night be dark for all of me. Let the night be too dark for me to see into the future. Let what will be, be." You're listening to Abundance, and I hope you've enjoyed some of the poetry of Robert Frost today. Some people have called him our almost poet laureate. Next up, Chapter 11 from The Plotter's Mile. The Plotter's Mile by Dane Allred. When Raymond Johnson robbed a bank with his big friend Tommy, they took the train, which was stopped by the police. Throwing the money on the tracks, Ray let Tommy get arrested. John Graham found the money, prepared a fake package, and turned in the evidence to his friend, Captain Greg Jones. On the way back to Ridgeway, Ray Johnson robbed a gas station and killed the attendant, Mike Shepard. Local reporter Paula Jones helped spread the news about the money being in Ridgeway and made her moves on Greg Jones. When Ray Johnson came to Greg's house to get one of the keys to the safe, he heard the commotion inside and left. When he went to the deputy's house, he got the first key from Deputy Larry Skinner, killed him, and took his gun and car. Johnson then went to visit Captain Greg Jones again for the other key. After a short scuffle, Raymond Johnson has the second key and leaves as he shoots Greg Jones. Plotter's Mile by Dane Allred. Chapter 11. By that time, most of the neighbors had been alerted by the gunshot, and the police captain's house is where most people decided to check first. Before long, a crowd had gathered in the front room of Captain Jones. Widow McGregor had stopped the bleeding from the shoulder and mopped up the blood on Jones's face, but he was still out cold. Many of his neighbors milled about the room, wondered just what had happened, and after congratulating each other on their bravery, wondered if the person who had wounded their police captain was still somewhere close by waiting to shoot them too. While they had called 911, any medical help would take about 30 minutes to reach the small town. That's about the time someone got the bright idea to call the state police and get some more protection here in their town. There had never been much more than accidental gunshot wounds in Ridgeway, and there had been that excitement several years ago with the drug dealer in the car chase. But it was especially unnerving to see your police captain, the man you depended upon for protection, bleeding in his own hallway. It was at times like these the townspeople were grateful that someone else took the risks to protect them. But if their protection was out of commission, how were they supposed to feel protected? Luckily, it was now that Greg Jones sat up and put his hand on his jaw, rubbing slowly. Looking around at his neighbors and seeing the fear in their faces, he said, "Did anyone get the license number of that truck?" Ray Johnson had the keys to the safe, transportation, and a weapon. He didn't intend to stay in Ridgeway a second longer than was necessary, because it didn't seem to him that the shot he got off killed the cop. He wasn't planning on staying around to see if the cop followed him to where they both knew he was going. The station. The shack Ridgeway called a police station was an embarrassment. It was so run down and dilapidated that no one ever talked of fixing up the place, just of what kind of building to have next. Most people favored moving it to the old woolen mills, which had been empty for 25 years and whose roof leaked in most places. It wasn't hard for Ray to break a window and unlock the door. Even easier was finding the safe, since it seemed to be the only reinforced part of the entire structure. Having both keys made all that reinforcement unnecessary. No one ever anticipated both officers being attacked. Ray was into the safe and grabbed the bundle in seconds. He rummaged around for anything else valuable and decided that Ridgeway must have been a very dull town indeed. He tucked the bundle under his arm and quickly walked to Larry's car. With the bundle, the car, Larry's gun, and a substantial head start on anyone who might want to follow, Ray decided to drive away from town, away from Tommy in his cell, and toward the bank they had originally robbed. The cops would never think of looking for him in that direction. Now all he had to do was find a place to hide for a day or two. Schmitty was on the way to Ridgeway when the call for help came. He listened to the details and reflexively sped the car up when he heard his good friend's name mentioned. Schmitty had seen the news broadcast earlier that night and cursed himself for suggesting it to Greg. He had forgotten Greg was being chased by that cute blonde from WGHH. He never imagined when he gave Greg the suggestion that the story would show up on the news that same night. He had wanted a couple of days to get some surveillance set up. As soon as he saw the story on the television, Schmitty knew there would be trouble, and this call about Greg being shot only confirmed his fears. This criminal was quick, and Schmitty kicked himself for not thinking all this through. Of course the guy would come back for the money, because he thought only he knew where the drop-off had been. When he saw the news that night, the short guy who ditched his partner must have done a backflip thinking he knew where the money was. Schmitty also thought he knew why Greg had been shot. The short guy wanted the vault key. "So, if I'm finally reading this right," Schmitty muttered to himself, "we're dealing with a pro, someone who isn't afraid to shoot a cop or anyone else." His thoughts raced, and he reached out the window to set the bubblegum machine turning. He sped up even faster. John Graham stood looking at his friend, Greg Jones. Widow McGregor had fixed him up so fast there was practically no blood on his arm at all. Greg was up, walking back and forth in his kitchen, tethered to the phone by a cord that was too short. He tried to call his deputy, but there had been no answer. Greg was now trying to get Smitty on the phone. He was also unavailable, and no one could tell Officer Jones where Harold was at the moment. When Greg hung up the phone, John pulled his friend down onto one of the kitchen chairs. "Greg, take it easy," said John. "You've been shot. You should get your arm looked at." "Just a flesh wound," Greg laughed, imagining himself to be striking a heroic figure. "Really, John, it was a clean shot. No bone, the muscle's a little sore. I don't know what old Lady McGregor put in that hole, but it is closed over, and the ibuprofen is taking care of the pain. What I'm worried about," he continued, "is that out there somewhere is a guy who thinks it was worth it to shoot me for the key to the office vault." John's eyes met Greg's. "You mean this is over the money?" John's eyes got big. Greg nodded and then said, "You saw the news tonight, right?" John nodded. "The state police said that might get the robber out of hiding," explained Greg, "but I didn't think it would work this fast. This has been one wild couple of days." Greg shook his head. "First a robbery, a train gets stopped, you find the money, and now someone wants my key bad enough to kill me for it. I would say we got his interest." "But why would he go to all this trouble just to get the $1,800, asked John, trying to seem innocent, while really wondering if it was time to fess up and go get the rest of the cash. Greg looked at John for a moment and then shook his head. "Someone must have got to the money first, and our robber thinks he has the whole wad." Greg paused for effect. "Any other ideas why he would do this?" Greg asked, indicating his wounded arm. Silence. Then John said, "I really have no idea why he would shoot you." Then more silence. Greg thought to himself that John probably knew more than he was saying, but for the second part of Schmitty's suggestion to work, it was better not to press John right now. Greg looked at his watch. "Is it really 8 a.m? he exclaimed. John saw no significance in the hour. "Yeah, it's 8. Why?" "I'm late for a breakfast appointment," Greg said, and grabbed his coat and dashed out the door. John and the other neighbors looked at each other and decided that if Greg Jones was not going to stay home, maybe they had better leave his house too. You're listening to Abundance in just a moment, Chapter 12 of A Plotter's Mile. Plotter's Mile, Chapter 12. As the sun was coming up, Raymond Johnson was looking for a good place to hide the car. But all there was in this part of the state was farms. He began looking for a dirt road to go down, and maybe he would be able to find some thick growth to hide the car in. On the left of the road, Ray saw a gap in the trees, and just past the big red barn, he turned down the road. It wound around for quite a while, and Ray decided, after about half a mile, that he was far enough from the main road, and the thick trees here would hide the car, too. He pulled over and got out of the car and stretched. Ray had been driving for about 2 hours, and the way he figured, if he waited the rest of this day, cops wouldn't be looking as hard for Larry's car as they do right away. As he stretched, Ray decided it was time to admire his handiwork and grabbed the bundle from the back seat. Pulling off the wrapping, Ray admired the green bills. Then he cut through the twine that was holding the whole package together. He pulled off the first bill and saw the stack of paper underneath. He flipped down a few more. Paper. Pulling the stack in half, he tossed the paper to the ground, looking desperately for the money for which he had killed 2 people. At the bottom of the pile, he found 9 more bills. He counted the total take. Only $1,800. Ray kicked the side of the car, putting a huge dent in the door. He screamed out loud to no one in particular. He grabbed the paper which had surrounded the bundle and pulled it flat, searching for another $100 bill. It was then he saw the evidence sticker that was stuck to the bottom of the wrapper. John Graham, 130 Walnut. A phone number. It was a receipt for $1,800. Ray stared at the paper for over a minute, trying to turn over the possibilities. The police had pulled him in like a fish, but did the police have the money? It could be in a bank safe somewhere else, but then why would this guy's name be on it? They used the $1,800 to get him to come collect the bundle, probably hoping to catch him then. Well, the cop who thought that up was either dead or had a bullet hole in him. But what about this address? Slowly, Ray walked around the car, pushing the fake paper bills away from the car with his feet. The wind was blowing them down the dirt road. He took the $1,800 from his pocket and looked closely at them. The serial numbers were consecutive, but the rest of the money was missing. What did it mean? John Graham was at home thinking hard about the mess he had created for himself. A gangster was out there somewhere wondering where the rest of his money had gone. His best friend had been shot because John wanted to keep money he'd found on the railroad tracks. His wife kept asking him what was wrong. He decided to go jogging and think. "I'm sorry," John explained. "I think I'm just worried about Greg. I'll be back in just a bit." Then he was out the door. He began thinking about running his 4th marathon. He wished he was running a marathon right now. Then he would have 5 hours to think. 5 hours was a terrible time for most marathon runners, but John was proud just to be able to finish, even though the runners who won the race could have run the course twice in that amount of time. It really did give you a sense of accomplishment to finish 26.2 miles, even if you were plodding while you were doing it. When you hit the 18 and 19 mile markers, you weren't sure if you would make it. Even though the biggest part was behind you, the wall runners talk about hitting becomes a massive stone behemoth ready to fall across you. At that point in the race, you'd be happy for a wall of rock to fall on you. But the 20 mile mark was magic because you knew you only had 6.1 miles left. The difference between 6.1 and 7.1 miles might as well have been 10 miles instead of just one. Maybe he was just in the last mile before the ending was in sight. Would he give up the money now and regret not having gone that last mile? Just like when he was running a marathon, John thought to himself that most difficulties were overcome by mental toughness and not necessarily by sheer strength. John jogged across the railroad tracks again, thinking about how these tracks had started the problems he now found himself in. John dug in and decided he could have the mental toughness to finish what he had started. This wall he felt pressing up against him would be temporary, unless the real wall was hidden somewhere up ahead. Ray was a slow thinker, but he was methodical. It only took about an hour, and he thought he had figured out where the money was and what this guy named John Graham had done. Ray figured this guy had hid it somewhere, probably in his house, and was hoping the bank wouldn't figure it out. Maybe this guy hoped Ray would get caught, go to jail for the robbery, and the money would never be found. Ray clenched his fists at the thought of someone else spending the money while he rotted in jail. There was no way that was going to happen, and Ray had a pretty good idea how to get his money back. Then Ray noticed some motion further down the road. As a shape in the distance got closer, Ray could tell it was a man carrying a gun. It could be a hunter, or it could be the cops, but then why would one person be walking up without even a warning? Just to be safe, Ray hid the revolver in his coat pocket. "Howdy," the man in the overall spoke first. "Hey," said Ray, "out hunting?" "Nah, just out shooting some old ammunition," said the old-timer, who looked to be over 70, to Ray. "Car trouble?" "Nah, just needed to stretch my legs for a while. I thought this road maybe led to a lake or something," said Ray, relaxing a bit. "Ah, there is a lake just around the corner of the fence," pointed the old geezer, using his gun to point and then waving it in Ray's direction. Ray tried hard not to flinch. "Thanks, I might drive down and check it out," said Ray. "Good fishing in the lake?" "Not bad," said the man. "Just be careful about the game warden. He don't like it when I catch too many fish." The old guy chuckled, and Ray got back into his car and said thanks again. Ray thought he might just camp out by the lake until tomorrow. Spending a night by the lake wouldn't be too bad, and by then the heat should be off. A gunshot made Ray jump in his seat. He looked back in the car mirror. A crow fluttered to the ground. The old guy walked over and kicked it with his foot. It was after 8:30 by the time Greg arrived back at Paula's room. As he knocked slowly, he could hear her in the room straightening up, probably making him wait because he made her wait. Well, he was late. But when the door opened, Paula's face turned from irritation to concern. "What has happened to you?" "I've been shot." He wasn't sure she believed him, but then she looked from his arm up to his face and then back to his arm. She couldn't get him in the room and down on a chair fast enough. Ray sat quietly by the lake planning his revenge. He hoped there was a family in the picture because that always made getting what you wanted easier. Every once in a while, he heard the old farmer's rifle, and Ray pictured John Graham being shot by Larry's gun, being held in Ray's hand. Too bad he didn't have a picture to make the visualization complete. That would come later. "You mean you got shot because of my report?" Paula pushed Greg's good shoulder, which made him wince because his whole body moved. She was immediately repentant, saying, "Oh, I'm sorry, did that hurt your arm? I can't believe you almost got killed because of me." She was on the verge of tears. "Calm down, it's not your fault," said Greg. "Remember, I'm the one who made the phone call and asked you to do the story. We just didn't think this guy would be so serious about getting his money so soon." "We?" Sorry, Greg apologized. We mean Schmitty. Harold Smith, one of my old friends who is the state investigator. You've met him. Paula looked confused. But I thought you told me he didn't get his money, just a small part of it. Yeah, but he didn't know all the money wasn't there, and I purposely decided not to tell you. And you were smart enough not to ask, smiled Greg, wondering why of all the jerks in the world she had to settle on this jerk who had just admitted using her. Don't you ever ask me to put you in danger again, she warned. I've spent far too much time trying to get to this point in my life without you dying on me. She reinforced the point by gently sitting down next to him and laying her head on his chest. You need me around to take care of you, it looks like, she purred. And I sure as hell need you around to take care of me. Dane Allred's Partly Colored Dreamcoat, Advanced Placement. Some barriers are placed in our way to test our resolve. Obstacles are clearly meant to be overcome, but how we overcome some of the obstructions in our world depends on our own creativity and convictions. After taking the ASVAB, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery, which tests to see if you know which nut belongs to which bolt and other things, I found out I could be a lawyer. The interest survey included with this test lets students choose the kinds of work they think they would like to do based on questions about their strengths, hobbies, and desires. I think my category told me I was socially oriented, and in that category were teachers, social workers, and lawyers. For no other reason than I wanted to make lots of money, and I thought being a lawyer sounded cool, I decided I would be a lawyer. I had no other interest in law before that, and luckily I ended up as a teacher. I love my job, and I wouldn't trade it for all the cash in China. But to get to be a teacher, I had to think I was going to be a lawyer first. I checked to see what kind of education was necessary for lawyers, and I noticed I was not enrolled in the right classes. Tracking is a way schools channel students into various classes, and even though it is technically not supposed to exist, the tracking of students takes place every day. I was a troublemaker in school, so I didn't really belong in the advanced classes, but to be a lawyer, I had to go to college, and I could get college credit while still in high school by taking advanced placement classes. I would have to pass the AP test at the end of the year, but I've always been a good test taker. Getting into AP history was easy enough, and once I was signed up for one AP class, I wanted another. AP English. But I had to take a test to see if I really could be an AP student, when really it should have been up to me to try and fail on my own. But the entrance test showed I should be able to handle the class, or they just wanted me to shut up, so I was enrolled. I was a busy senior, acting in plays, doing the morning announcements, even speaking at graduation. But this meant I was not always in class receiving the precious words of wisdom from my teachers, which meant there was no way I'd be able to pass the test at the end of the year. Both of my AP teachers told me not to waste my money by taking the test. This only strengthened my resolve. Think about the benefits of passing the test. If I could get a passing score, I could have 24 college credits on my transcript before the first day at the university. Back then, you didn't even have to pay to get the college credit. They just added it to your total. Today, most colleges charge what the tuition would have cost for those credits, but at least you don't have to spend the time. I would get a double free ride if I passed. I'm not sure why we discourage people from trying to achieve. Maybe we think the specter of failure will permanently disfigure them. What really happens is most people who are knocked down and get up again gain a valuable lesson. They learn how to get back up again when they're knocked down. It's really not so bad on the ground unless that's where you stay. I'm sure both of these teachers thought they had my best interests in mind when they told me not to take the tests, but I don't take that kind of obstruction seriously. Easily overcome, I marched into the test with my head held high, knowing that I was the master of my destiny. And if I failed the tests, I would only be out $100 or so. But if I passed the tests, I would save myself thousands of dollars and cut time off my degree. I passed both tests and had 24 credits. After I took some other college-level examination program tests, CLEP tests, I had tested out of a year of college. I finished a 4-year degree in 3 years. If I had listened to the naysayers who were sure I wasn't college material, I would have missed out on all the fun I've had since then. But then again, I was in the workforce full-time by the age of 21. Maybe I should have overcome these obstructions at a slower pace. I must really love my work.